The three biblical passages are Psalm 49, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 12 to 14, and chapter 2, verses 18 to 23. And the third reading is from the Christian Testament, is Luke 12, 13 to 21. Life, death, and living in search of God. These three passages are each about finitude and mortality and address the unique human trait, knowing we will die. You can't take it with you, whether it's your wisdom or your money, and you don't get to influence what those who inherit your things choose to do with them when you are gone. There is a radical equality between all of us, and that is death. Psalm 49 belongs to the wisdom tradition. In verses 1 to 4, we hear a promise to reveal wisdom and understanding and to solve life's riddle with the help of a harp. There have been arguments in faith communities from the time these passages were written as to whether wisdom literature, such as these passages, belonged alongside the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, plus the prophets and the history. I, for one, am glad they're there. In the wisdom tradition, and in this psalm, we have a stark emotional expression, a stark complaint about the bullies, the rich, and our seeming powerlessness within the system. We hear our brethren cry out for the meaning of life in the face of death. These verses are simple words that also reside in our minds and hearts. They don't give advice, but demonstrate a shared understanding of our sometimes spiritual turmoil and anxiety. We too have experienced people who treat us poorly, without care and respect. We too face the diminishment of strength, power, and finally our deaths. We too experience Schadenfreude, a little delight in that those we dislike also die. But it's not much consolation. There is no satisfaction or peace in the psalm. The passage from Ecclesiastes is also in the wisdom tradition and continues this theme of turmoil and anxiety, introducing the theme of our powerlessness to influence the world and those who inherit our money. This turmoil and anxiety, part and parcel to being human, is picked up by the storyteller Jesus in Luke 12. A well-off farmer, very good at planning and amassing wealth, doesn't have enough in his own eyes. He is blessed with plenty of harvest, more, in fact, than can fit in his barns, plural, at present. He plans to tear them down and build bigger ones, only to be confronted with his imminent death. In addition to this parable of the farmer, Jesus may have had Psalm 49 in mind when he taught in Mark about saving one's life and about entering the kingdom of God. For what will it profit one to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give him in return for their life? That is from Mark 8. And how hard it will be for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God? Mark 10. Confronted with these teachings about life, death, and money, I tend to look at the bigger picture, the sin of systemic injustice. Systemic injustice is a broad concept, easier to examine as the source of pain than looking at myself. In his book Convictions, Marcus Borg cites the governing systems in place during the time of the psalmist and in Jesus' day. The monarchs and their caretakers were something like 1 to 2% of the population. Under them were retainers, those in charge of the military, builders, food distributors, all those handling money, and then the administrators and scribes. All these other people add up to about 7 or 8% of the population, while the remaining 90% of the people had no voice in how the system was operated and were economically exploited. He points out that today, are things really better with 1%? With 1% of the population owning 43% of the wealth in our country. Just last week, I read another statistic that is not so different from this one, that in our country, 0.1% of people have wealth equal to the bottom 90%. Our system, with variations of representative democracy, which is truly under threat, is far, far more fair than those systems several millennia ago. But by how much? Borg contends that Jesus had something to say about the way we organize ourselves in community. That when a society is structured to serve the interests of the wealthy and powerful, it is not a just society. It is true that working for systemic change is the task at hand, in my opinion. How can we structure our economy so all can have not just a living wage, but a way to thrive? But when I am truthful, I need to acknowledge that these biblical passages hurt for another reason, too. They touch something real in us, that we spend time concerned, sometimes consumed, thinking about money and whether we have enough. We equate well-being with material wealth. It's unconscious, like breathing. We're told in our culture, on our radios, TVs, and computers, maybe 1,000 times more than my mom and dad were told growing up in the 1930s, that we don't have enough. If we only have a new cell phone, a bigger house, the vacation to, that we are enough. And we are told and shown image after image that wealth means personal worth. Enough money means enough worth. George Carlin, I'm guessing many of you know George Carlin, even though he was active some decades ago. He has a routine, which is, of course, not biblical, but I'll go out on a limb and call it biblical in its truth. Carlin, you got your stuff with you? I bet you do. You have stuff in your pockets. You have stuff in your purses. Stuff is important. You got to take care of your stuff. You got to have a place for your stuff. That's what life is all about, trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is, a place to keep your stuff. If you didn't have so much stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You could just walk around all the time. So now you have a house full of stuff, and even though you might like your house, you got to move. Got to get a bigger house. Why? Too much stuff. And that means you got to move all your stuff, or maybe put some of your stuff in storage. Storage, imagine that. There's a whole industry based on keeping an eye on other people's stuff. We live in the wealthiest nation on earth, but who hasn't looked at Architectural Digest or House Hunters and seen a dream home overlooking the Pacific and imagined a blissful life? Here's a truth, one that the psalmist and author of Ecclesiastes and Jesus may not want to hear. Money can make you happier up to a certain point. In a 2010 study at Princeton Center for Health and Well-being, we learned that income can increase emotional well-being and how we evaluate our lives. It's fair to assume that poverty increases struggles of life and therefore equates to greater unhappiness. But can we, in turn, assume that money will lead to more happiness? According to this Princeton study, people are less happy when they live below the threshold of $75,000 per U.S. household. But above $75,000, happiness increases incrementally. The struggles and strains of having more money balance the benefit of that money. The report also says that people with over $75,000 have something that does increase, and they call it satisfaction. I'm not exactly sure what satisfaction is. Maybe this satisfaction has to do with purchasing things and places to live that are more beautiful, more tranquil. Maybe it's a kind of false satisfaction as we compare ourselves to others and believe more means more self-worth. Maybe increased satisfaction due to more wealth is correlated with our ability to give more money away, and be recognized for it. But if satisfaction is something about sating our desires, about gaining positive judgment from others versus intrinsic satisfaction over who we are and what we contribute, then I don't put much weight in this statistic. Whether we're talking about happiness or satisfaction, Jesus is clear that a good life, as defined by him, is not about wealth and what we can buy with it. Our stuff may satisfy, but it will not save us. In fact, at some point, it becomes an impediment to our relationship with God. I contend it is not only the accumulation of goods that deceives us. We, like the farmer, imagine that leisure, eating, drinking, and an open schedule will make us happy, will be fulfilling, will in some ways save us. We mistake less pressure in our lives for happiness. But the truth is that many people fail retirement. A time when their schedule is fully open, they discover what is true for all of us. We need challenge and the ability to contribute, to be whole people. There is another false promise in money, which is even more subtle. Money gives us the illusion that we are independent and self-sufficient. It is true, we can make ourselves independent and self-sufficient, building homes that are larger and larger, often meaning they are also at increased distances from others. People with more wealth buy services rather than look their neighbor in the eye and share eggs or childcare or tools. In such a world of self-reliance, we don't need to give gifts or share our time. In a world of self-reliance, we don't need to give gifts or share our time. So it looks like wealth is the culprit. But I ask you to consider the pandemic. Was it wealth and the independence and self-sufficiency it buys that you were craving during the pandemic? What I experienced and read about is that we were longing for connection, mattering, contribution to the common good, trust, community, and all of these require other people. Wealth may contribute to us finding ourselves alone and unhappy, but more clearly, our estrangement from others and God was and is our downfall. There is bad news and good news. Nothing will keep us from facing death. The truths of these biblical passages are plain. We can't determine how those after us will use the resources we gathered. We sometimes feel despair thinking about the end of our lives. Will anyone read the book we wrote? Will anyone keep our garden? Will anyone remember our contributions to the company? Will anyone extol the beautiful meals we labored over? A cemetery stone from the early 1800s marking the life and death of my great-great-grandfather in Urbana is nearly illegible. Even inscribed stones deteriorate. I'm grateful that in our Christian tradition, talking about death is something we do every year on Ash Wednesday when ashes remind us of our mortality. There is also good news in these texts, even though we have to look hard for it. We have a choice. To fill ourselves with things and satisfaction and build a bigger barn, or fill ourselves with people and God. We have a chance to weigh the question, how much is enough? Despite the constant lure of the TV and internet, whose goal is to grab our attention with every screen, every advertisement, every image, we have a choice to turn it off, mute, and/or find another activity that focuses our attention on what matters. We can search for God in our lifetimes and trust we are in God's arms in our death. I'm going to invite you into an exercise. I'm asking you to bring to mind a gift you received that you cannot repay. Any gift you have received that you cannot repay to the giver. I'll give you 1 minute to consider the giver, the gift, and how you feel when you reflect on this gift. Is there anyone who would enjoy sharing who the giver is and their relationship to you, what gift you are giving, and how it feels to reflect on this gift? One gift reported was the gift of life. Another parishioner offered up the gift of having campaign managers for an election, all the people who supported her. So there's so many precious gifts. What is so delicious about these gifts? We connect, we're seen, we get creative thinking of the gifts we can make for others. We realize these kinds of gifts are so terribly important to us. This summer, my daughter is teaching yoga, leading hike and bike tours, and occasionally giving SUV tours of a beautiful R&R spot in nature. She has met some very rich people. A few weeks ago, she was driving three guys on a tour of this ranch. The conversation as they headed out to see the beauty of the mountains and valleys was about their wealth, the challenges of raising children in very wealthy families, and their very different political views. At this point in her story, I was feeling so sad, wondering how she was dealing with this, making up stories about how she must have been rolling her eyes in the back of her head and counting the hours until she was done with this tour. I was wrong. She told me that she joined the conversation, shared with these guys that she was interested in their conversation about raising children because she wanted to have children one day. She chose to connect versus disconnect. I was so proud and humbled by her maturity. The next thing that happened was that these guys wanted to go off-road under some interesting bridge, and the SUV they were in, despite being four-wheel drive, got stuck. Jenna was ready to radio for help, but these three guys wanted to have at it and get the car out. It took quite a bit of time and sharing ideas, but together they got the car out. And guess what? The ride back was much more relaxed, fun, and jovial. More important and more fun than seeing the property, the irrigation, the animals, more important than their wealth and their political views, was working together to solve a problem. Perhaps we need Psalm 90 to accompany Psalm 49, where the reality of death draws the psalmist more fully into life. It says, "So teach us to count our days that we may gain a wise heart," or better translated, "Teach us to make every day count." So what is the advantage of having faith? It seems to be that with faith, we work to make every day count and entrust our lives and future to God. A friend of mine surprises me from time to time. It seems to me that even though she is only 70 and in good health, she is preparing for the end of her earthly life. A few months ago, she asked me to consecrate her on her 70th birthday. I'd never been asked to consecrate a person before. Baptize, yes. Consecrate, no. And I figured that I was being asked to bless or acknowledge her sacred journey. I share these words with you because I wish them for all of us. Please receive this blessing. Close your eyes if you wish. Rest your heart in God. For as many years as you have left in this life, rest your heart in God. Be and become the creature you have been called to become. Float on the stream and then rest on the bank. Be blown by the wind and then find refuge in your dwelling. Love and be loved. May your presence heal hearts and may theirs heal you. Trust what God can do with rivers and puddles, acorns and mustard seeds, soil and dust. Find a way to be God's partner and receptacle. Savor your part in nature, for you are one being living with and alongside all the other beings blessed by your Creator. One day, not yet, you will rest without the world by your side, in God's hands.